Cory Doctorow, and I'm back. It's been a while. I was out of town. I was in Santa Cruz with Randall Monroe from XKCD and San Francisco for the Pioneer Awards with William Gibson, and then out on the Writing Excuses cruise all around the Caribbean, and then in Toronto for three consecutive events, and then in Maine for the Maine Library Association, and then in Portland, Maine for a gig with my old pal James Patrick Kelly. And now I am home and at my desk and not going anywhere for a while. Well, that's not quite true, but I am staying put more than I usually do. And the next thing you can catch me at, if you happen to be in Brussels on November the 11th, I'll be doing an appearance for the Edge Riders Foundation in an event they're throwing. I'll have more details on that soon. And apart from that, nothing else in 2019 except for personal travel and private gigs for work. But I do have lots of news. The first really cool piece of news is that today, as I record this, Monday, the 7th of October, we have just released the cover of Posey the Monster Slayer, my very first picture book, which is coming out on July the 14th, 2020. It's a story about a little girl who loves monsters, and at night when the monsters come to her room, she hunts them for sport, repurposing her girly toys, her super gendered toys, as field expedient monster killing weapons. For example, she maces the beholder in its giant, lidless, terrible, staring eye with her bubblegum scented perfume, and more in that vein. And that'll be out next July. I've also signed the contract and received the initial payment for the third Little Brother book. And we even have a title, but it hasn't been announced. But I will tell you soon what that is. And that'll likely also be a 2020 title, maybe early 2021. And given that that book is now in the can and sold and edited and all of those things, I have begun work on my next novel. It doesn't have a title yet. It's a book about the aftermath of the Green New Deal, and specifically about truth and reconciliation, and what you do after a revolution with the people who are on the other side. It's a pretty important question these days, I think. And as a warm-up for that, I just finished a short story for a new magazine out of the UK called Smith Magazine, called Filling the Holes, and I'll be putting that online once it's available. So that's all the news that's fit to print. I'm going to read to you today an op-ed I wrote for the Globe and Mail, which is one of Canada's national newspapers. I wrote it as a tie-in for the Six Degrees conference, which I spoke at when I was in Toronto, and it got a very good public notice and lots of commentary, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Why do people think the Earth is flat? A funny thing happened on the way to the 21st century. Even as old conspiracy theories were growing more implausible, they also became more popular. Take the flat Earth. Never before in human history have more people seen the curvature of the Earth with their own eyes. From climate denial to anti-vax to a resurgent eugenics movement, we are in a golden age of terrible conspiratorial thinking with real consequences for our species' continued survival on our decidedly spherical planet. Ideas spread because of some mix of ideology and material circumstances. Either ideas are convincingly argued, and/or they are delivered to people whose circumstances make them susceptible to those ideas. Conspiracies aren't on the rise because the arguments for them got better. The arguments for alternative medicine or against accepted climate science are no better than those that have lurked in the fringes for generations. Look up the 19th century skeptics who decried the smallpox vaccine, and you'll find that anti-vax arguments have progressed very little in more than a century. The people panicking over these developments have an explanation for the newfound vigor of conspiracy theories. They say the big tech platforms have developed the equivalent of mind control rays that beam even mediocre ideas past our rational defenses. They say that ad-driven companies such as Google and Facebook threw so much R&D at using data mining to persuade people to buy refrigerators, subprime loans, and fidget spinners that they accidentally figured out how to rob us of our free will. These systems put our online history through a battery of psychological tests, automatically pick an approach that will convince us, then bombard us with an increasingly extreme, increasingly tailored series of pitches until we're convinced that creeping Sharia and George Soros are coming for our children. This belief is rooted in a deep and completely justified mistrust of the big tech companies, which have proved themselves liars time and again on matters of taxation, labor policy, complicity in state surveillance and oppression, and privacy practices. But this well-founded skepticism is switched off when it comes to evaluating big tech's self-serving claims about the efficacy of its products. Exhibit A for the mind control ray theory of conspiratorial thinking is the company's own sales literature, wherein they boast to potential customers about the devastating impact of their products, which, they say, are every bit as terrific as the critics fear they are. Call me a cynic, but I don't know why we doubt every utterance from big tech except their marketing claims. I just don't believe in mind control. The underlying science behind sentiment analysis and Big Five personality type classifiers is, to put it charitably, hotly contested by research psychologists. And while the non-consensual dossiers that big tech has compiled on countless people certainly help them target people, that is, by showing fridge ads to people who search for refrigerator reviews, or by suggesting that people who hang out in white supremacist adjacent forums might want to send money to Faith Goldie, or go to Charlottesville with a supply of tiki torches. There's not much evidence that big tech represents any meaningful advance on persuasion. Big tech can find you people who might be amenable to your pitch, and you can automate much of the record keeping associated with refining that pitch, but the pitch itself, that's a stubbornly unscientific craft. If conspiracies aren't attributable to ideology or mind control rays, then we're left with one remaining possibility, that material circumstances of the people who believe in conspiracies made them vulnerable to bad ideas, even ones that are as implausible as eugenics, anti-vax, and the flat earth. It's tempting to think that conspiracies represent a disagreement about what is true, but at root, they are a disagreement about how we know whether something is true or not. When we argue about the flat earth, we're not just debating the shape of our planet, we're debating the method by which we can know its shape. The modern way of knowing things for sure is through formal truth-seeking exercises. In these, an official body convenes a formal, transparent investigation into some question: how to calculate the load stresses on the joists that hold up our buildings, whether we should be eating more plants and fewer animals, whether a given medication is safe. They hear from experts who present their best evidence and rebuttals. The bodies deliberate and make a decision and publish that decision and explain their rationale. These systems work because when they fail safe. The people involved are bound by ethics rules that keep them out of temptation's way. Their work is on display so that any failures can be caught by third parties. The system is subject to appeal and repeal as new facts are revealed. For these systems to work, they need to be fair and honest. But 40 years of rising inequality and industry consolidation have turned our truth-seeking exercises into auctions in which lawmakers, regulators, and administrators are beholden to a small cohort of increasingly wealthy people who hold their financial and career futures in their hands. Industry consolidation makes it startlingly cheap to buy the truth. Once an industry consists of a handful of players, it's easy for everyone to agree on the play, and the only people qualified to be referees are drawn from the company's own executive ranks, whence they will return after a spin in governance's revolving door. Why don't we agree on the urgency of climate change? Because of a moneyed conspiracy to make us doubt it. Why did we let a single family amass riches greater than the Rockefellers while peddling OxyContin and claiming it wasn't addictive? Because of a moneyed conspiracy. Why do some 737s fall out of the sky? Why are our baby bottles revealed to be lined with carcinogenic plastics? Why do corrupt companies get to profit by consorting with the world's most despicable dictators? Conspiracies. In other words, big tech doesn't have a mind control ray, but it does have an incredibly sophisticated people-finding machine. And if you're looking for people who might believe in your conspiracy, it helps if there's a massive pool of people around who've been battered and had their lives irreparably harmed by conspiracies. To be in a world where the truth is up for auction is to be set adrift from rationality. No one is qualified to assess all the intensely technical truths required for survival. Even if you can master media literacy and sort reputable scientific journals from junk pay-for-play ones, even if you can acquire the statistical literacy to evaluate the studies for rigor, Even if you can acquire the expertise to evaluate claims about the safety of opioids, you can't do it all over again for your city's building code, the aviation safety standards governing your next flight, the food safety standards governing the dinner you just ordered. In such a world, you're left nominating experts to tell you which claims are accurate and which ones aren't. I believe in the medical science about vaccines because of trusted scientist friends. I disbelieve the waning medical claims about opioid safety for the same reason. But my epidemiologist friends have no expertise when it comes to structural steel, diesel emissions, or climate science. In a pluralistic world, we can aspire to the rule of law, in which rigorous systems keep human frailty in check. In an oligarchic world, we're left finding people who sound like they know what they're talking about and putting our trust in them. If your people tell you that opioids are killing you and possibly save your life in the process, and then follow it up by telling you that the earth is flat or George Soros wants to weaken your social fabric by funding asylum seekers and paid protesters, well, what yardstick can you measure these statements against? Big tech is part of the problem, but not because they have a mind control ray. Rather, it's because they have monopolies, thanks to decades of buying nascent competitors and merging with their largest competitors, of cornering vertical markets and crushing the rivals who won't sell. Big tech means that one company is in charge of the social lives of 2.3 billion people. It means that another company controls the way we answer every question that it occurs to us to ask. It means that companies can assert the right to control which software our devices can run, who can fix them, and when they must be sent to a landfill. These companies, with their tax evasion, labor abuses, cavalier attitudes towards our privacy, and their completely ordinary human frailty and self-deception, are unfit to rule our lives. But no one is fit to be our ruler. We deserve technological self-determination, not a corporatized internet made up of five giant services, each filled with screenshots of the other four. It's hard to seize the means of computation, but step one is ending oligarchic controls. We need to break up all of our consolidated industries, energy, transport, accountancy and auditing, entertainment, telecoms, media, news, tech, everything from eyeglasses to pro wrestlings to movie studios to pharmacies, to say nothing of pharmaceutical companies. We can never be sure whether our beliefs are true ones, but unless we can look where the evidence leads us, even when it gores a billionaire's ox, our beliefs will trend towards catastrophic falsity. All right, well, that's my Globe and Mail column. I'll talk to you next week. And if you're in Brussels, keep an eye out for that Edge Riders event on November the 11th. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Sharealike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.